From Philadelphia, it's Torah Talk. Hello everyone, I'm Michael Karasik, and this week we are reading Parshat Naso, numbers 4:21 to the end of chapter 7, and I thought I would look at the verse at the end of chapter 7, which I've done before, but not for a while. It is the 89th verse of the chapter. 7, 8, 9 sounds like a lucky roll of the dice, but if I go back to the first verse of the chapter to remind you what is happening, the first verse of the chapter says, "On the day that Moses finished setting up the tabernacle, he anointed it and consecrated it," and so forth. That day when Moses finished setting up the tabernacle brings us back to the end of the book of Exodus, Exodus 40, where that day occurs in the straightforward timeline. We've talked about setting up the tabernacle throughout the book of Leviticus. The ceremony happens, and now we're going back and saying again, in a different way, that each of the 12 tribes, I hope you're not bored yet with me telling you, reminding you that Numbers is the book of the tribes, the one of the five books of the Torah that cares about the 12 tribes of Israel. And there's a paragraph in number 7 for each of the 12 tribes that sounds like this: "The one who presented his offering on the first day was Nachshon, son of Amminadav of the tribe of Judah. His offering, one silver bowl weighing 130 shekels and one silver basin of 70 shekels by the sanctuary weight, both filled with choice flour with oil mixed in, for a meal offering. One gold ladle of 10 shekels filled with incense, one bull of the herd, one ram, one lamb in its first year for a burnt offering, one goat for a sin offering, and for his sacrifice of well-being, 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 he-goats, and 5 yearling lambs. That was the offering of Nachshon, son of Amminadav. And if this is your bar or bat mitzvah week, you know that that paragraph is repeated 12 times. You really don't have to learn as much as some kids do, because the only thing that changes in the next paragraph, with one or two very slight exceptions, is the name of the guy and of his father and of his tribe. And then finally, in Numbers 7:84, there's a whole paragraph of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 5 verses, 5 more verses, that give you the totals if you add up what each of the 12 guys donated, which was identical for all the 12 of them, that they give you the sum totals in verses 84 through 88. And all of a sudden, in Numbers 7:89, we read this: "When Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with him," him, capital H in the JPS translation, "he would hear the voice," capital V, "addressing him," small h, "from above the cover that was on top of the capital A ark of the capital P pact between the cherubim, the two cherubim. Thus, capital H, he, spoke to lowercase h, him." Out of the blue of this chapter full of, I don't want to say boring detail, but of endlessly repeated detail that would seem of interest to the, let's say, the certified priestly accountant, but not to the ordinary reader of the Torah. And all of a sudden, this verse that seems to talk not about something that happened on one of these particular 12 days, but whenever Moses went into the tent of meeting. I should say that Baruch Levine, who comments on Numbers in the Anchor Bible, has a very nice tabular reconstruction of all the offerings in this chapter. And he says, in fact, number 7 is a highly instructive source of information about the accounting methods employed by the priests of biblical temples and by representatives of other agencies operating within biblical society over an extended period of time. And it's a good point that those of us who came to the Bible through stories sometimes tend to skip over, at least mentally, to pay less attention to these more technical passages. But there's in fact tremendous amount of interesting information to be learned about ancient Israel and its people from them. But then, says Levine, in his comment on verse 89, chapter 7 concludes with a cryptic verse intended to acknowledge the function of the tabernacle as an oraculum. I like that word. In Exodus 25:22, we read that God would, quote, meet Moses, unquote, in the inner chamber of the tent and speak to him from the space above the kaporet, the expiation lid. And then Levine goes on to discuss the word, the verb middaber, the very unusual hitpael form of the verb to speak, which is ordinarily in the pl binyan, ledaber. This is lehitdaber. The T and the D blend into each other, and you can't hear the difference, but that's why there's a dagesh in the first letter of this root. The import of 789 is phenomenological. Moses would customarily hear God speaking to him from above the cherubs. That's the import of the hitpael, I guess Levine is saying. He would customarily hear God speaking to him from above the cherubs. The last words of the verse recapitulate what has been said. Vayedaber elav, literally he equals God, spoke to him, Moses. This reading seems to accord with other priestly depictions of the process, Exodus 25:22, though it is surely tempting to translate small h, he equals Moses, would then speak to him equals God. Well, most of the commentary on this verse deals with this strange hitpael form of the verb to speak, deals with the question about how exactly God communicated with Moses, which is described differently in different places, deals with the kol, kuf vav Lamed, not kaf kol, meaning all, but kuf vav lamed, the voice or sound that Moses would hear from above the kaporet in this verse. And Rashi's comment at the top of page 2 of the handout deals with all of those things. I will let you look at that on your own. These are the main focuses of the commentary. Here is Neely Fox in the Jewish Study Bible saying this appended verse reiterates how Moses communicates with God in the tent of meeting, the portable site for revelation where God dwells. God's name is not mentioned, but is substituted by the voice, in italics, the voice. It sounds like a TV show, a term that is the precursor of the rabbinic bat kol, daughter of the voice, or echo, signifying a divine voice from the heavens. Well, is this kol, this voice, a hypostasis of God? You can look that word up, hypostasis. Not going to go into it now, but in an article on that subject by Azan Yadin Israel of Rutgers University, he quotes a scholar named H. McNeil, saying that this verse is, quote, an isolated and mutilated fragment. And that's what I want to think a little bit more about this week. not the kol, not the midaber, not how God communicated with Moses, but what is this verse doing here so seemingly out of place? Jacob Milgram says in the JPS Numbers commentary, both the thought of this verse and the word him, capital H him, lack any antecedent. It has been noted that the promise in Exodus 25:22 that God would communicate with Moses from above the ark is not fulfilled in any of the passages that speak of the building of the tabernacle, for example, Exodus 37 and Exodus 40. Moreover, its absence there is deliberate, since Exodus 40, verses 34 through 35, explicitly state that Moses was not able to enter the tent because of the density and power of God's presence, that's God's kavod, as we've often talked about on the podcast, the density and power of God's presence when the sacrificial laws of Leviticus 1 through 7 were revealed to him. Only upon the conclusion of the first public service after the seven-day consecration of the tabernacle was Moses and also Aaron permitted to enter the tent, Leviticus 9:23. And I'm going to remind you that seven-day consecration somehow is going on simultaneously with this 12-day consecration, which, as I've pointed out in earlier years, neither of them pays any attention to the at least one of those days that must have been the Sabbath. Milgram continues, this, I guess that Moses could only now go into the tent, this is perhaps what our text means to convey. Beginning with the priestly blessing at the first service, Numbers 6, 22 through 27, and Leviticus 9, 22 through 23, God's commands to Moses, like the instructions concerning the chieftain's gifts in Numbers 7, 4, were delivered to him from the ark throne while he stood alone inside the tent. Before that, he could not go into the tent because it was filled with the kavod. God must have somehow minimized the kavod in a kind of kabbalistic tzimtzum enough to let Moses and later Aaron in. Abraham Ibn Ezra says on our verse, number 789, when Moses went into the tent of meeting, this might mean, quote, the first time that Moses went into the tent, indicating the original divine utterance of Leviticus 1:1 after the dedication was complete. Well, I don't like to argue with Ibn Ezra. That's not true. Everyone likes to argue with Ibn Ezra. This is not the most natural way to say the first time that Moses went into the tent, but it could mean that. As Moses went into the tent, here's what happened. He heard the kol. But it seems to me that it can't be a coincidence that there's another cryptic, isolated, and mutilated fragment at the beginning of the book of Leviticus, which you'll remember occurs in the plot of the Torah at exactly the same moment as Numbers chapter 7 is happening. Leviticus 1:1, don't read it in your English Bible. Read it in Hebrew. Don't read it in your English Bible unless your English Bible was translated by Everett Fox, who translates more closely to the Hebrew, making clear something that most translations obscure. Leviticus chapter 1, verse 1, this is the beginning of the book of Leviticus, and he called to Moshe, Moshe is Moses, of course, and he called to Moshe, dash, YHWH, spoke to him from the tent of appointment. So most translations make YHWH, the Lord, that's the Tetragrammaton, make the Lord the subject of the very first verb in the book, but it is not in the Hebrew. In the Hebrew, that's a verb that just is in third masculine singular without an explicit subject. He, I guess it could even be it, called to Moses, and then you fall back into normal Hebrew. Adonai, the Lord, spoke to him from the tent of appointment. That's the tent of meeting in JPS, the Ohel Moed. Here is Benjamin Summer from thetorah.com. Again, I'll put the link is on the handout this week. YHWH's simulated speech, the priestly interpretation of prophecy. And I'm quoting to you only one line from this. Anything Ben writes is very well worth reading always. Only one sentence. Numbers 7:89 represents P's own commentary on its earlier statement in Leviticus 1:1, as well as on another earlier verse in P, Exodus 25:22. But because our chapter is retelling the story of Leviticus 9 from a completely different perspective, the perspective of the tribes, it seems to me that Numbers 7:89 is not a commentary on, but a different version of Leviticus 1:1, again leaving very obscure how the dialogue between Moses and God is initiated. And just like in Leviticus 1:1, where someone calls to Moses and then the Lord speaks to him in plain Hebrew, Numbers 7:89 is followed immediately by Numbers 8:1, even though Jews never read it immediately that way, because that's next week's episode. Numbers 8:1, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Vayedaber Adonai el Moshe l'emor, and then there are instructions about the menorah. Biblical scholars, like me, love to talk about the different voices in the Torah. I don't think we talk enough about the different voices within the priestly sections of the Torah. I'm very fond of throwing around P and H, but which one is Leviticus 1:1 and which one is Numbers 7:89, or are there others? Why do they both focus on the communication between God and Moses in such an obscure way, and then pick it up as if it were just like lifting the phone? I'll be back with you next week with the parasha named after the very first word that Moses is supposed to tell his brother Aaron, Beha'alotcha, when you mount the lamps. Until then, this is Michael Karasik saying, thank you for listening.